When Avery stopped for diesel around noon, the gas station television was blaring with news that the Justice Department would investigate the aliens for abducting human children. She escaped into the restroom to check her phone. The internet was ablaze with speculation: who the translators were, whether they could be freed, whether they were human at all. The part of the government that had approved Lionel's road trip was clearly working at cross purposes with the part that had dreamed up this new strategy for extracting information from the aliens. The only good news was that no hint had leaked out that an alien was roaming the back roads of America in a converted bus. Henry had texted her a cryptic suggestion to head toward Paris. She had to Google it to find that there actually was a Paris, Kentucky. When she came out to pay for the fuel, she was relieved to see that the television had moved on to World Series coverage. On impulse, she bought a Cardinals cap for Lionel. Paris turned out to be a quaint old Kentucky town that had once had delusions of cityhood. Today, a county fair was the main event in town. The RV park was almost full, but Avery's ET Express managed to maneuver in. When everything was settled, she sat on the bus steps sipping a bud and waiting for night so they could venture out with a little more anonymity. The only thing watching her was a skittish, half-wild cat crouched behind a trash can. Somehow, it reminded her of Lionel, so she tossed it a Cheeto to see if she could lure it out. It refused the bait. That night, disguised by the dark and a Cardinals cap, Lionel looked tolerably inconspicuous. As they were leaving to take in the fare, she said, "Will Mr. Burbage be okay while we're gone? What if someone tries to break into the bus?"
"Don't worry, he'll be all right," Lionel said.
His tone implied more than his words. She resolved to call Henry at the earliest opportunity and pass along a warning not to try anything. The people in the midway all looked authentic. If there were snipers on the big top and agents on the merry-go-round, she couldn't tell. When people failed to recognize Lionel at the ticket stand and popcorn wagon, she began to relax. Everyone was here to enjoy themselves, not to look for aliens. She introduced Lionel to the joys of corn dogs and cotton candy, to the Ferris wheel and tilt-a-whirl. He took in the jangling sounds, the smells of deep-fried food, and the blinking lights with a grave and studious air. When they had had their fill of all the machines meant to disorient and confuse, they took a break at a picnic table, sipping Cokes. Avery said, "Is Mr. Burbage enjoying this?" Lionel shrugged. "Are you?" He wasn't deflecting her question. He actually wanted to know. She considered. "I think people enjoy these events mainly because they bring back childhood memories," she said.
"Yes, it does seem familiar," Lionel said.
"Really? What about it?" He paused, searching his mind.
"The smells," he said at last.
Avery nodded. It was smells for her, as well. Deep fat fryers, popcorn. "Do you remember anything from the time before you were abducted?"
"Adopted," he corrected her.
"Right, adopted. What about your family?" He shook his head. "Do you ever wonder what kind of people they were?"
"The kind of people who wouldn't look for me," he said coldly.
"Wait a minute, you don't know that. For all you know, your mother might have cried her eyes out when you disappeared."
He stared at her.
She realized she had spoken with more emotion than she had intended. The subject had touched a nerve. "Sorry," she muttered, and got up. "I'm tired. Can we head back?"
"Sure," he said, and followed her without question.
That night she couldn't sleep. She lay watching the pattern from the lights outside on the ceiling, but her mind was on the back of the bus. Up to now, she had slept without thinking of the strangeness just beyond the door, but tonight it bothered her. About 3 a.m., she roused from a doze at the sound of Lionel's quiet footstep going past her toward the door. She lay silent as he eased the bus door open. When he had gone outside, she rose and looked to see what he was doing. He walked away from the bus toward a maintenance shed and some dumpsters. She debated whether to follow him. It was just what she had scolded him for doing to her. But concern for his safety won out, and she took a flashlight from the driver's console, put it in the pocket of a windbreaker, and followed. At first she thought she had lost him. The parking lot was motionless and quiet. A slight breeze stirred the pines on the edge of the road. Then she heard a scuffling sound ahead, a thump and a soft crack. At first she stood listening, but when there was no more sound, she crept forward. Rounding the dumpster, she saw in its shadow a figure crouched on the ground.
Unable to make out what was going on, she switched on the flashlight. Lionel turned, his eyes wild and hostile. Dangling from his hand was the limp body of a cat, its head ripped off. His face was smeared with its blood. Watching her, he deliberately ripped a bite of cat meat from the body with his teeth and swallowed. "Lionel!" she cried out in horror. "Put that down!" He turned away, trying to hide his prey like an animal. Without thinking, she grabbed his arm, and he spun fiercely around as if to fight her. His eyes looked utterly alien. She stepped back. "It's me, Avery," she said. He looked down at the mangled carcass in his hand, then dropped it, rose, and backed away. Once again taking his arm, Avery guided him away from the dumpsters, back to the bus. Inside, she led him to the kitchen sink. "Wash," she ordered, then went to firmly close the bus door. Her heart was pounding, and she kept the heavy flashlight in her hand for security. But when she came back, she saw he was trembling so hard he had dropped the soap and was leaning against the sink for support. Seeing that his face was still smeared with blood, she took a paper towel and wiped him off, then dried his hands. He sank onto the bench by the kitchen table. She stood watching him, arms crossed, waiting for him to speak. He didn't. "So what was that about?" she said sternly. He shook his head. "Cats aren't food," she said. "They're living beings." Still he didn't speak. "Have you been sneaking out at night all along?" she demanded. He shook his head.
"I don't know. I just thought I wanted to see what it would feel like."
"You mean Mr. Burbage wanted to see what it would feel like," she said.
"Maybe," he admitted.
"Well, people don't do things like that." He was looking ill. She grabbed his arm and hustled him into the bathroom, aiming him at the toilet. She left him there vomiting and started shoving belongings into her backpack. As she swung it onto her shoulder, he staggered to the bathroom door. "I'm leaving," she said. "I can't sleep here knowing you do things like that." He looked dumbstruck. She pushed past him and out the door. She was striding away across the gravel parking lot when he called after her. "Avery, you can't leave." She wheeled around. "Can't I? Just watch me." He left the bus and followed her.
"What are we going to do?"
"I don't care," she said.
"I won't do it again."
"Who's talking, you or him?" A light went on in the RV next to them. She realized they were making a late-night scene like trailer park trash, attracting attention. This wasn't an argument they could have in public. And now that she was out here, she realized she had no place to go. So she shooed Lionel back toward the bus. Once inside, she said, "This is the thing, Lionel. This whole situation is creeping me out. You can't make any promises as long as he's in charge. Maybe next time he'll want to see what it feels like to kill me in my sleep, and you won't be able to stop him." Lionel looked disturbed.
"He won't do that."
"How do you know?"
"I just do."
"That's not good enough. I need to see him." Avery wasn't sure why she had blurted it out, except that living with an invisible, ever-present passenger had become intolerable. As long as she didn't know what the door in the back of the bus concealed, she couldn't be at ease. He shook his head.
"That won't help."
She crossed her arms and said, "I can't stay unless I know what he is." Lionel's face took on an introspective look, as if he were consulting his conscience. At last he said,
"You'd have to promise not to tell anyone."
Avery hadn't really expected him to consent, and now felt a nervous tremor. She dropped her pack on the bed and gripped her hands into fists. "All right." He led the way to the back of the bus and eased the door open as if fearing to disturb the occupant within. She followed him in. The small room was dimly lit and there was an earthy smell. All the crates he had brought in must have been folded up and put away because none were visible. There was an unmade bed, and beside it a clear box like an aquarium tank, holding something she could not quite make out. When Lionel turned on a light, she saw what the tank contained. It looked most like a coral or sponge, a yellowish, rounded growth the size of half a beach ball, resting on a bed of wood chips and dead leaves. Lionel picked up a spray bottle and misted it tenderly. It responded by expanding as if breathing.
"That's Mr. Burbage?"
Avery whispered. Lionel nodded. Part of him. The most important part. The alien seemed insignificant,
something she could destroy with a bottle of bleach.
Can he move? She asked.
Oh, yes, Lionel said. Not the way we do. She waited for him to explain. At first he seemed reluctant, but he finally said, They are colonies of cells with a complicated life cycle. This is the final stage of their development when they become most complex and organized. After this, they dissolve into the earth. The cells don't die. They go on to form other coalitions. But the individual is lost. Just like us, I suppose. What she was feeling, she realized, was disappointment. In spite of all Lionel had told her, she had hoped there would be some way of communicating. Before, she had not truly believed that the alien could be insentient. Now she did. In fact, she found it hard to believe that it could think at all.
How do you know he's intelligent? She asked. He could be just a heap of chemicals like a loaf of bread rising.
How do you know I'm intelligent? He said, staring at the tank. Or anyone.
You react to me. You communicate. He can't.
Yes, he can.
How, if I touched him?
No, Lionel said quickly. Don't touch him. You'd see, he would react. It wouldn't be malice, just a reflex.
Then how do you?
Reluctantly, Lionel said, He has to touch you. It's the only way to exchange neurotransmitters.
He paused as if debating something internally. She watched the conflict play across his face. At last, reluctantly, he said,
I think he would be willing to communicate with you.
It was what she had wanted, some reassurance of the alien's intentions.
But now it was offered, her instincts were unwilling.
No thanks, she said.
Lionel looked relieved.
She realized he hadn't wanted to give up his unique relationship with Mr. Burbage. Thanks anyway, she said, for the generosity of the offer he hadn't wanted to make.
And yet it left her unsure. She had only Lionel's word that the alien was friendly. After tonight, that wasn't enough. Neither of them could sleep, so as soon as day came, they set out again. Heading west, Avery knew they were going deeper and deeper into isolationist territory, where even human strangers were unwelcome, never mind aliens. This was the land where she had grown up, and she knew it well. From here, the world outside looked like a violent, threatening place full of impoverished hordes who envied and hated the good life in America. Here, even the churches preached self-satisfaction, and discontent was the fault of those who hated freedom, like college professors, homosexuals, and immigrants. Growing up, she had expected to spend her life in this country. She had done everything right, married just out of high school, worked as a waitress, gotten pregnant at 19. Her life had been mapped out in front of her. She couldn't even imagine it now. This morning, Lionel seemed to want to talk. He sat beside her in the co-pilot seat, watching the road and answering her questions.
What does it feel like when he communicates with you?
He reflected. It feels like a mood or a hunch, or I act on impulse.
How do you know it's him and not your own subconscious?
I don't. It doesn't matter. Avery shook her head. I wouldn't want to go through life acting on hunches. Why not?
You're unconscious. It's unreliable. You can't control it. It can lead you wrong.
That's absurd, he said. It's not some outside entity. It's you. It's your conscious mind that's the slave master, always worrying about control. Your unconscious only wants to preserve you. Not if there's an alien messing around with it. He's not like that. This drive to dominate, that's a conscious thing. He doesn't have that slave master part of the brain.
Do you know that for a fact, or are you just guessing?
Guessing is what your unconscious tells you. Knowing is a conscious thing. They're only in conflict if your mind is fighting itself.
Sounds like the human condition to me, Avery said. This had to be the weirdest conversation in her life. Is he here now? She asked.
Of course he is.
Don't you ever want to get away from him?
Puzzled, he said, Why should I?
Privacy, to be by yourself.
I don't want to be by myself.
Something in his voice told her he was thinking ahead to the death of his lifelong companion. Abruptly, he rose and walked back into the bus. Actually, she had lied to him. She had gone through life acting on hunches. Go with your gut had been her motto, because she had trusted her gut. But of course, it had nothing to do with gut or heart. It was her unconscious mind she had been following. Her unconscious was why she took this road rather than that, or preferred Raisin Bran to cornflakes. It was why she found certain tunes achingly beautiful, and why she was fond of this strange young man, against all rational evidence. As the road led them nearer to southern Illinois, Avery found memories surfacing. They came with a tug of regret, like a choking rope pulling her back toward the person she hadn't become. She thought of the cascade of non-decisions that had led her to become the rootless, disconnected person she was, as much a stranger to the human race as Lionel was, in her way. "What good has consciousness ever done me?" she thought. It only made her aware that she could never truly connect with another human being, deep down. And on that day when her cells would dissolve into the soil, there would be no trace her consciousness had ever existed. That night, they camped at a freeway rest stop a day's drive from St. Louis. Lionel was moody and anxious. Avery's attempt to interest him in a trashy novel was fruitless. At last she asked what was wrong. Fighting to find the words, he said, "He's very ill. This trip was a bad idea. All the stimulation has made him worse." Tentatively, she said, "Should we head for one of the domes?" Lionel shook his head. "They can't cure this addiction to consciousness. If they could, I don't think he'd take it." "Do the others, his own people, know what's wrong with him?" Lionel nodded wordlessly. She didn't know what comfort to offer. "Well," she said at last, "it was his choice to come."
"A selfish choice,"
Lionel said angrily. She couldn't help noticing that he was speaking for himself, Lionel, as distinct from Mr. Burbage. Thoughtfully, she said, "Maybe they can't love us as much as we can love them." He looked at her as if the word love had never entered his vocabulary.
"Don't say us," he said. "I'm not one of you."
She didn't believe it for a second, but she just said, "Suit yourself," and turned back to her novel. After a few moments, he went into the back of the bus and closed the door. She lay there trying to read for a while, but the story couldn't hold her attention. She kept listening for some sound from beyond the door, some indication of how they were doing. At last, she got up quietly and went to listen. Hearing nothing, she tried the door and found it unlocked. Softly, she cracked it open to look inside. Lionel was not asleep. He was lying on the bed, his head next to the alien's tank. But the alien was no longer in the tank. It was on the pillow. It had extruded a mass of long, cord-like tentacles that gripped Lionel's head in a Medusa embrace, snaking into every opening. One had entered an ear, another a nostril. A third had nudged aside an eyeball in order to enter the eye socket. Fluid coursed along the translucent vessels connecting man and creature. Avery wavered on the edge of horror. Her first instinct was to intervene, to defend Lionel from what looked like an attack. But the expression on his face was not of terror, but peace. All his vague references to exchanging neurotransmitters came back to her now. This was what he had meant. The alien communicated by drinking cerebrospinal fluid, its drug of choice, and injecting its own. Shaken, she eased the door shut again. Unable to get the image out of her mind, she went outside to walk around the bus to calm her nerves. After three circuits, she leaned back against the cold metal, wishing she had a cigarette for the first time in years. Above her, the stars were cold and bright. What was this relationship she had landed in the middle of? Predator and prey? And son? Pusher and addict? Master and slave? Or some strange combination of all? Had she just witnessed an alien learning about love? She had been saving a bottle of bourbon for special occasions, so she went in to pour herself a shot. To her surprise, Lionel emerged before she was quite drunk. She thought of offering him a glass, but wasn't sure how it would mix with whatever was already in his brain. He sat down across from her, but just stared silently at the floor for a long time. At last he stirred and said, "I think we ought to take him to a private place." "What sort of private place?" Avery asked.
"Somewhere dignified. Natural. Secluded."
To die, she realized. The alien wanted to die in private. or Lionel wanted him to. There was no telling where one left off and the other began.
I know a place, she said.
Will he make it another day?
Lionel nodded silently.
Through the bourbon haze, Avery wondered what she ought to say to Henry. Was the country in danger? She didn't think so. This seemed like a personal matter. To be sure, she said, you're certain his relatives won't blame us if he dies?
Blame? He said.
That was conscious talk, she realized. React when he doesn't come back?
If they were going to react, they would have done it when he left. They aren't expecting anything, not even his return. They don't live in an imaginary future like you people do.
Wise of them, she said.
Yes.
They rolled into St. Louis in late afternoon, across the Poplar Street Bridge next to the Arch and off onto I-70 toward the north part of town. Avery knew exactly where she was going. From the first moment Frank had told her the destination was St. Louis, she had known she would end up driving this way, toward the place where she had left the first part of her life. Bellefontaine Cemetery lay on what had been the outskirts of the city in Victorian times, several hundred acres of greenery behind a stone wall and a wrought iron gate. It was a relic from a time when cemeteries were landscaped, park-like sanctuaries from the city. Huge old oak and sweet gum trees lined the winding roadways, their branches now black against the sky. Avery drove slowly past the marble mausoleums and toward the hill at the back of the cemetery, which looked out over the valley toward the Missouri River. It was everything Lionel had wanted. Peaceful, natural, secluded. Some light rain misted down out of the overcast sky. Avery parked the bus and went out to check whether they were alone. She had seen no one but a single dog walker near the entrance, and no vehicle had followed them in. The gates would close in half an hour, and the bus would have to be out. Henry and his friends were probably waiting outside the gate for them to appear again. She returned into the bus and knocked on Lionel's door. He opened it right away. Inside, the large picnic cooler they had bought was standing open, ready.
Help me lift him in, Lionel said.
Avery maneuvered past the cooler to the tank. Is it okay for me to touch him?
Hold your hand close to him for a few seconds.
Avery did as instructed. A translucent tentacle extruded from the cauliflower folds of the alien's body. It touched her palm, recoiled, then extended again. Gently, hesitantly, it explored her hand, tickling slightly as it probed her palm and curled around her pinky. She held perfectly still.
What is he thinking? She whispered.
He's learning your chemical identity, Lionel said.
How can he learn without being aware? Can he even remember?
Of course he can remember. Your immune system learns and remembers just about every pathogen it ever met, and it's not aware. Can you remember them all?
She shook her head, stymied.
At last, apparently satisfied, the tendril retracted into the alien's body. All right, Lionel said. Now you can touch him. The alien was surprisingly heavy. Together, they lifted him onto the bed of dirt and wood chips Lionel had spread in the bottom of the cooler. Lionel fitted the lid on loosely, and each of them took a handle to carry their load out into the open air. Avery led the way around a mausoleum shaped like a Greek temple to an unmowed spot hidden from the path. Sycamore leaves and bark littered the ground, damp from the rain. Is this okay? She asked. For answer, Lionel set down his end of the cooler and straightened, breathing in the forest smell.
This is okay.
I have to move the bus. Stay behind this building in case anyone comes by. I'll be back. The gatekeeper waved as she pulled the bus out onto the street. By the time she had parked it on a nearby residential street and returned, the gate was closed. She walked around the cemetery perimeter to an unfrequented side, then scrambled up the wall and over the spiked fence. Inside, the traffic noise of the city fell away. The trees arched overhead in church-like silence. Not a squirrel stirred. Avery sat down on a tombstone to wait. Beyond the hill, Lionel was holding vigil at the side of his dying companion, and she wanted to give him privacy. The stillness felt good, but unfamiliar. Her life was made of motion. She had been driving for 20 years, driving away, driving beyond, always a new destination. never back. The daylight would soon be gone. She needed to do the other thing she had come here for. Raising the hood of her raincoat, she headed downhill, the grass caressing her sneakers wetly. It was years since she had visited the grave of her daughter, Gabrielle, whose short life and death was like a chasm dividing her life into before and after. They had called it crib death then, an unexplained, random, purposeless death. Nothing you could have done, the doctor had said, thinking that was more comforting than knowing that the universe just didn't give a damn. Gabrielle's grave lay in a grove of cedar trees, the plot a gift from a sympathetic patron at the cafe where Avery had worked. At first, she had thought of turning it down, because the little grave would be overshadowed by more ostentatious death. But the suburban cemeteries had looked so industrial, monuments stamped out by machine. She had come to love the age and seclusion of this spot. At first, she had visited over and over. As she approached in the fading light, she saw that something was lying on the headstone. When she came close, she saw that some stranger had placed on the grave a little terracotta angel with one wing broken. Avery stood staring at the bedraggled figurine, now soaked with rain, a gift to her daughter from someone she didn't even know. Then, a sudden, unexpected wave of grief doubled her over. It had been 20 years since she had touched her daughter, but the memory was still vivid and tactile. She remembered the smell, the softness of her skin, the utter trust in her eyes. She felt again the aching hole of her absence. Avery sank to her knees in the wet grass, sobbing for the child she hadn't been able to protect, for the sympathy of the nameless stranger, even for the helpless, mutilated angel who would never fly. There was a sound behind her, and she looked up. Lionel stood there watching her, rain running down his face. No, it was tears. He wiped his eyes, then looked at his hands. I don't know why I feel like this, he said. Poor, muddled man. She got up and hugged him for knowing exactly how she felt. They stood there for a moment, two people trapped in their own brains, and the only crack in the wall was empathy. Is he gone? She asked softly. He shook his head. Not yet. I left him alone in case it was me. Interfering. Then I saw you and followed. This is my daughter's grave, Avery said. I didn't know I still miss her so much. She took his hand and started back up the hill. They said nothing but didn't let go of each other till they got to the marble mausoleum where they had left Mr. Burbage. The alien was still there, resting on the ground next to the cooler. Lionel knelt beside him and held out a hand. A bouquet of tentacles reached out and grasped it, then withdrew. Lionel came over to where Avery stood watching. I'm going to stay with him. You don't have to. I'd like to, she said, if it's okay with you. He ducked his head furtively. So they settled down to keep a strange death watch. Avery shared some chemical hand warmers she had brought from the bus. When those ran out and night deepened, she managed to find some dry wood at the bottom of a groundskeeper's brush pile to start a campfire. She sat poking the fire with a stick, feeling drained of tears, worn down as an old tire. Does he know he's dying? She asked. Lionel nodded. I know, and so he knows. A little bitterly, he added, that's what consciousness does for you. So normally he wouldn't know? He shook his head. Or care. It's just part of their life cycle. There's no death if there's no self to be aware of it. No life, either, Avery said. Lionel just sat breaking twigs and tossing them on the fire. I keep wondering if it was worth it. If consciousness is good enough to die for. She tried to imagine being free of herself, of the regrets of the past and fear of the future. If this were a Star Trek episode, she thought, this would be when Captain Kirk would deliver a speech in defense of being human, despite all the drawbacks. She didn't feel that way. You're right, she said. Consciousness kind of sucks. The sky was beginning to glow with dawn when at last they saw a change in the alien. The brain-like mass started to shrink and a liquid pool spread out from under it, as if it were dissolving. There was no sound. At the end, its body deflated like a falling souffle, leaving nothing but a slight crust on the leaves and a damp patch on the ground. They sat for a long time in silence. It was light when Lionel got up and brushed off his pants, his face set and grim. "Well, that's that," he said. Avery felt reluctant to leave.
"His cells are in the soil?" she said.
"Yes, they'll live underground for a while, spreading and multiplying. They'll go through some blooming and sporing cycles. If any dogs or children come along at that stage, the spores will establish a colony in their brains. It's how they invade."
His voice was perfectly indifferent. Avery stared at him. "You might have mentioned that," he shrugged. An inspiration struck her. She seized up a stick and started digging in the damp patch of ground, scooping up soil in her hands and putting it into the cooler.
"What are you doing?" Lionel said. "You can't stop him, it's too late."
"I'm not trying to," Avery said. "I want some cells to transplant. I'm going to grow an alien of my own."
"That's the stupidest."
A moment later, he was on his knees beside her, digging and scooping up dirt. They got enough to half fill the cooler, then covered it with leaves to keep it damp. "Wait here," she told him. "I'll bring the bus to pick you up. The gates open in an hour. Don't let anyone see you." When she got back to the street where she had left the bus, Henry was waiting in a parked car. He got out and opened the passenger door for her, but she didn't get inside.
"I've got to get back," she said, inclining her head toward the bus. "They're waiting for me."
"Do you mind telling me what's going on?"
"I just needed a break. I had to get away."
"In a cemetery? All night?"
"It's personal."
"Is there something I should know?"
"We're heading back home today."
He waited, but she said no more. There was no use telling him. He couldn't do anything about it. The invasion was already underway.
He let her return to the bus, and she drove it to a gas station to fuel up while waiting for the cemetery to open. At the stroke of 8:30, she pulled the bus through the gate, waving at the puzzled gatekeeper. Between them, she and Lionel carried the cooler into the bus, leaving behind only the remains of a campfire and a slightly disturbed spot of soil. Then she headed straight for the freeway. They stopped for a fast food breakfast in southern Illinois. Avery kept driving as she ate her egg muffin and coffee. Soon Lionel came to sit shotgun beside her, carrying a plastic container full of soil.
"Is that mine?" she asked.
"No, this one's mine. You can have the rest."
"Thanks."
"It won't be him," Lionel said, looking at the soil cradled on his lap.
"No, but it'll be yours. Yours to raise and teach."
"As hers would be. I thought you would have some kind of tribal loyalty to prevent them invading," Lionel said.
Avery thought about it a moment, then said, "We're not defenseless, you know. We've got something they want. The gift of self, of mortality. God, I feel like the snake in the garden. But my alien will love me for it."
She could see the cooler in the rearview mirror, sitting on the floor in the kitchen. Already she felt fond of the person it would become, gestating inside.
"It gives a new meaning to alien abduction, doesn't it?" she said.
He didn't get the joke. "You aren't afraid to become something like me?"
She looked over at him. "No one can be like you, Lionel." Even after all this time together, he still didn't know how to react when she said things like that.